Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
So I'm going to talk about Catholic social teaching tonight. Start right from the foundations with Pope Leo XIII, after whom the current pope is named, and then go on and look at some of the highlights of other popes and culminate with Pope John Paul II, who has the most kind of recent and important things to say, and then also a couple other comments about the two most recent popes. In Rerum Novarum in 1891, that was the first time a pope in a big way addressed the problems of modern society, especially economic problems. And he did it in an encyclical, that's a letter, a long letter, called Rerum Novarum. And the context of this was he's living in a time now, Europe has been transformed, so has North America, with the Industrial Revolution. People used to be predominantly rural, now they were predominantly urban. Now industry is producing more than agriculture. A lot of production is no longer done by little shopkeepers in little, you know, like shoemakers' houses and shops and things, but now mass-produced in factories. This is creating all sorts of problems. There's going to be uprootedness. People are going to leave their villages, move to these big anonymous cities to try to find work. There's going to be people living in overcrowded housing, these so-called slums. There's going to be a lot of diseases, of malnutrition, of airborne and waterborne diseases. A lot of insecurity. There's no real unemployment insurance, no retirement benefits, no health insurance. People are really kind of uprooted from a more secure life and thrown into a troubled one. And Pope Leo XIII is going to attack this situation really vehemently. He'll say, a few rich owners, society's becoming a few rich owners, and then large numbers of impoverished workers. Workers that have no protection. In the Middle Ages and early modern times, you had guilds to protect you, and they regulated prices, and they regulated job conditions and wages and all of that. And now that's gone by the wayside. Workers are exposed to the vagaries of the economy. I will quote you here from Leo. By decrees, it has come to pass that working men have been surrendered, isolated and helpless, to the hard-heartedness of employers and the greed of unchecked competition. He says, covetous and grasping men are practicing rapacious usury. A small number of very rich men have been able to lay upon the teeming masses of the laboring poor a yoke little better than that of slavery itself. My students think that that's Karl Marx writing this. Karl Marx, I don't think, ever wrote something so vehement about capitalism. That comes right from the Pope. The Pope sees the enemy as something called liberalism. Whatever you think liberalism is or what it means to you, forget that, because it meant something different in the late 19th century, and it means something different on the European continent. What it means is uncontrolled capitalism. Capitalism where the state just lets the businesses run without any intervention. And the Pope says this is actually a bad system. The state is ignoring its responsibility toward protecting those who are weaker. It's an unjust system that rewards ruthlessness and selfishness. It treats people like expendable raw materials as inputs for production and nothing more. It ignores the common good. It's all about the individual rights of the people that own the businesses. And it makes property rights absolute, and it's agnostic. There's no God involved. This can run with any sort of, on any sort of moral or transcendent principles. He says that one of the big problems with this liberalism or uncontrolled capitalism is it causes a reaction of people turning to revolutionary ideologies like Marxism. And so you get socialists. He would call them socialists, but we would call them more, you know, revolutionary Marxists. And he says they're going to exploit the situation. They're going to use the poor's envy of the rich to get the state to take over the private property. It gives the state way too much power. The capitalist system gives the state too little power, and the socialist system gives it too much power. Now you have an interventionist state meddling in people's lives, bossing people around. Instead of the worker being able to earn his living and save and invest and spend his money how he sees fit, Now you have the government pretty much takes your money and it spends it for you as it sees fit. He says this Marxism feeds off envy, resentment, discord. It promotes those things in society because that's where it draws its power. He says that its ideal of equality is not only unrealizable, but if realized, it would level everyone to a condition of misery and degradation. It would take away motives to work hard. It would cause the sources of wealth to run dry. It violates the natural human right to private property. Property is not absolute. That's why the liberal system's wrong. But property also is a right. That's why the socialist system's wrong. The truth is right down somewhere in the middle. He says it's utopian. That's a huge problem with revolutionary Marxism. It's always been. It's promising things that it could never deliver on. It's promising to banish troubles from human life. It's pretending that the proper ideology and policies can rid life of pain and trouble and bring ease and enjoyment to everyone. That's a delusion. It also feeds off conflict. It sees conflict as inevitable. It's based on class hatred. It foments class hatred even on and on and on. And then Pope Leo adds that, you know, classes don't have to be hostile. They are hostile at times. They fight with each other. They have class differences. But also, capital and labor need each other. They can cooperate for the common good. You know, for example, everybody at Boeing wants to sell airplanes. It doesn't matter if you're the CEO, the board of directors, the engineers, the guys on the assembly line, the mechanics, the guy sweeping the floors. Everybody wants to sell airplanes. There's common interest in the economy. It doesn't have to be conflictual. And these relationships are manageable. It's not like you have to have a bloody revolution and turn everything into state property to get rid of social conflict. A lot of this, what he's saying, almost all of it, I think, is just spot on as a critique of that whole Marxist system. And this is before he's ever come to power. And this is before, you know, if you look at it from the other side of the century, you'll see it's a hugely repressive. It throws hundreds of thousands of people into labor camps, genocide, kills millions of people. And he's not even talking about those things. He's just talking about, you know, as it looks on paper, what would be the implications, and they don't look great. Leo then also has to establish the point that why does the church speak out on this stuff? And he said it has a right and a duty to speak out. And rights and duties are going to be connected a lot. So if you learn one thing from tonight's lectures, be able to make that connection. The church has teachings that can guide our conduct, especially regarding what are your rights and what are your obligations. It has organizations that can help the working person, especially Catholic trade unions. That was a big thing that the Pope was pushing. And it can mediate social conflicts and help be like the honest broker that brings conflicting people together. The Catholic vision, according to Pope Leo XIII, is a lot has to do with rights and obligations. So first of all, workers and management and owners have mutual obligations toward each other. The workers are supposed to work fully and faithfully, not engage in violence, not have riots, not cause disorders, not destroy property of the owners. Not personally attack the owners, the employers. And the employers are to respect the workers' dignity, not treat them just like inputs for production, used for profit, not cheat them out of their wages, and not pay unjustly low wages. Paying a just wage is going to be a Catholic principle from Leo XIII right till today. Church teaching is the market alone cannot be determining your income. That if the market doesn't give you a decent income, and decent means enough to support a family and have a little left over, then there's a problem. And popes like to quote, especially, there are Bible verses about this. A lot, I think, from Old Testament, like Sirach and places like that, but also a letter of James. To defraud anyone of wages that are his due is a great crime, which cries to the avenging anger of heaven. And the church will teach that workers are due a decent wage. The Pope also believes they should have Sundays off, limits on working hours, proper rest and leisure. And this whole idea of a living wage, it's older than modern labor contracts. It's more authoritative than a wage agreement. And the wages should be sufficient to support a frugal and well-behaved wage earner. Now, if you're not frugal or well-behaved, that's another story. But if you're willing to work hard, not waste a lot of money, spend all the money on various frivolous things, you should get a decent wage and live a decent life. If you're forced to work for starvation wages, you are a victim of injustice. If you're so poor you'll work for less money than it takes to survive on, That's a problem with the system. That's not your fault. Other considerations. Pope makes a big deal that virtue is important. It's not just that the system might have problems, but you need to be frugal. You need to live a simple life. You need to avoid vices that will dissipate your income and your inheritance and things like that. He talks about the role. State has a role, has an important role. It enforces laws. It keeps public order. It protects private property. It's supposed to serve the common good and has special consideration for the working class and the poor. The church will later call this the preferential option for the poor. That whenever there's a policy, whenever there's an issue, and you're looking for how to respond to it, the first question you should ask yourself is, what's the impact of this on the poor? What's the impact of this on working people, people that have less protection against all the problems you might encounter in life? Or I'll quote the Pope here on this. The richer classes have many ways of shielding themselves and stand less in need of help from the state, whereas the mass of the poor have no resources of their own to fall back upon and must chiefly depend upon the assistance of the state. So when you have less money, your life hits you harder. Flannery O'Connor would say, she writes about poor people a lot because they have less cushioning between them and all the problems of life, so you get a lot more drama. And so Pope says that should be the priority, is looking out for those people, the people that are the most vulnerable whenever you're making any sorts of position. They don't have to determine your decision, but they have to at least be taken into serious consideration. That wage earners should be specially cared for and protected by the government. And things like regulating working hours, wages, working conditions, all those things the state has the right to do to make sure there's justice in the economy. And also this will help limit strikes and labor unrest and so on and so on. And he says expressly, but this doesn't mean the state should be meddling in all sorts of other things. It should stay out of the family. It should only intervene if there's really a dire, urgent necessity. Very directly, very focused, not simply start taking on all sorts of responsibilities and powers that aren't its own. So that's the foundation of Catholic social teaching. It's from 1891, that's Pope Leo. And now I want to talk about all the other popes from him until the new Leo. I call this Between the Lions, Catholic social teaching over the last 100 and so many years. So Pius XI, in 1931, did an encyclical called Quadragesimo Anno, 40 years after Rerum Novarum. Any year ending in a 1, the Pope is likely to have some kind of social statement in honor of Rerum Novarum of 1891. So in 1931, it's 40 years later. Russia is now communist, it's actually Stalinist. Italy is fascist. The Nazis aren't in power yet in Germany, but things are heading that way. And the capitalist world is mired in a big depression. And so Pius XI is going to address these issues and continue pretty much Leo's perspective. He's going to start to talk more about the market being kind of driven by immorality, in the sense that if you have a business and you want to market your product, you've got to get people to buy things they don't need, get people to buy things they don't afford. If you're involved in something like alcohol or gambling, you want to convince people to get addicted and give their money to you. So he talks about how the whole system is sort of stacked against people. And he also begins this Catholic search for a third way. If you don't like communism, you don't like capitalism, what else is there? And so Pope will start to posit alternatives, which I don't have time to go into. You can ask later if you want. Pope also, in a later encyclical, he's going to have an encyclical against communism. I think it was just came out like a day or two after or before his encyclical against the Nazis. And he makes the point that there are priests and bishops suppressing Catholic social teaching because they don't want their parishioners to hear it, and this is only helping the communists, and that needs to stop. They need to, rich people and their allies in the church have to stop undermining things that the Pope's actually saying about the system that is critical. Let's jump ahead to 1961. So it's, again, one of those years ending in a 1. The Pope is now John the 23rd, and he issues Mater et Magistra, Mother and Teacher. That's the church, our mother and our teacher. And it's a commentary on the social issues in the world around him. And he's going to make a couple of points that I think are worth, I'll just kind of hit highlights now of the different popes and what are their main points, or the points that might be most resonant today. So John the 23rd, and I remember, I grew up in this time, it was very optimistic in the 60s. It was like, we're building all these, it's the space age. We're at the dawning of the space age. There'll be jet packs. We'll be flying through the air before you know it, and riding flying saucers, and everyone, the world's getting richer, and we're technologically solving our problems. And there was a sense, humans don't need God anymore, that humans can rely more and more on themselves and their technology and their science, and they can build a really wonderful civilization apart from any sort of religious belief. And John the 23rd says it's actually the opposite, that these scientific advances have become engines of destruction. They can lead to disaster. We can destroy a lot now with our technology. He was thinking of weapons. I think communications technology is even more dangerous. But whatever, these great advances don't make the need for God, morality, and spirituality less. You need them more. You need something that's really going to constrain these potentially very deadly forces. And if you don't have that, you're very much endangered. So life isn't getting safer because of our technology, and we don't need religion anymore. It's quite the contrary. He also says that it's in the wealthier parts of the world that people seem to be increasingly dissatisfied with their lives. So happiness and wealth don't really necessarily go hand in hand. 2 years later, he writes Pacem in Terris. That's his encyclical on peace on earth, it's called. And it's going to also comment on social issues. And it's going to put a big stress on human rights. And he's going to talk about, you know, human being, you're a person with rights and duties. And they always go together. You don't have rights without duties. There's a huge stress on human rights. He mentioned over 40 of them. There's even more probably. Catholics give you a lot. They don't give you all the rights you want, but they give you more rights than anybody else. So I'll just read off a few. You have the right to food, clothing, shelter, medical care, rest, and necessary social services. Those are your rights. You have the right to be looked after in case of ill health, being disabled at work, being a widow, being old, enforced unemployment, not only if you're just some lazy slacker or loafer that doesn't want to work, but if you're forced out of employment, you have a right to support. You have a right to be respected. You have a right to your good name. You have a right to freedom of speech and publication. But qualified, it has to be within the limits of the moral order and the common good. If you're violating the moral order or damaging the common good, then you know your freedom of speech is not absolute. It can be limited. You have the right to be accurately informed about public events. I always think that's an interesting one. You have the right to a good general education or technical and professional training. You can't, your society can't just let you remain uneducated if you're trying to get better training and education. You have the right to educate your children. You have the right to be given the opportunity to work. You have the right to be allowed to exercise personal initiative in your work. So if you take initiative and your boss yells at you, you can tell your boss he's violating your human right. You have the right to a just wage, you know, enough to live a decent life on, to raise a family, and to have some left over as well. And a big point John the 23rd makes, and all popes will make this, is there's a connection between rights and duties. Because you have a right, you have a corresponding duty. And because you have a duty, you have a right attached to it as well. And I'll just give you a few examples, some that most that the Pope used, one I'll throw in on my own. You have a duty to work, and you have a right to a job. You have a right to a job that presents you with pays you with a just wage. You can't tell people they have a duty to work if you have a system that can't provide them with jobs. You have a right to property. You also have a responsibility to use the property for the common good. Just because you own it doesn't mean you can do whatever you want with it. The socialists will tell you you don't even own it, and that's wrong. But the liberals or capitalists or whatever will tell you it's yours, you can do whatever you want with it, that's wrong too. You have a right to life, and now you have a duty to take care of your health. You have a right to seek the truth, and a duty to seek the truth. You have a right to free speech, and a duty to speak the truth. In your speech, if people start abusing these rights, the rights themselves become weakened, and more people think, why do we even have that right? It's just doing damage to us. Pope John 23rd says, when there's mutual recognition, and this goes back to Leo, when there's some sort of social disharmony, just look at the situation, whose rights are being neglected, who's not fulfilling their obligation. And it's usually looking through that lens that can get you to the root of any kind of social conflict. What rights do you have? Who's violating them? What responsibilities do you have to fulfill? Are you or are you not fulfilling them? There's usually problems on both sides, but that's where you look. What are your rights? Are they being honored? What are your responsibilities? Are they being fulfilled? And wherever that equation falls short, that's what you have to address to improve the situation. Well, then Vatican II comes along. The Pope at the time starts out John 23rd, and then it becomes Paul VI. Paul VI says something that I always thought Pope John Paul said, but an awful lot of what popes say are actually said by an earlier pope, that there's a real continuity in Vatican teaching. Paul VI said, a man is more precious for what he is than for what he has. And that issue of being versus having is going to be a big part of Catholic social teaching. Vatican II, in Gaudium et Spes, one of its major documents, says there's three errors we make in our approach to the world. One is to believe that we can shirk our worldly responsibilities, neglect our temporal duties. It says literally in the document that if you do that, you jeopardize your eternal salvation. And that's probably the one of all the sins connected with social justice and social teaching, that's probably the one I would feel most prone to, because I just get so disgusted by politics. It's just like, not my circus, not my monkeys, that's somebody else's life. But you have to care. The church requires that you care. You don't have to care always in the same way. Or you don't have to care by putting, a politician's sign in your yard, but you have to at least care and want to do something that affects the world around you in a good way. The second error, or sin really, is to engage in earthly affairs, but bracket them off from your faith so that whatever you're doing in the world is disconnected or even sometimes conflictual with what you believe. Like, I'll believe X on Sunday, but I'll act on Y through, Monday through Saturday, I'll act on Y. So you can't do that either. You can't bracket off your faith or keep it isolated. And then the third thing is confusing your own personal opinion with the gospel message and think that Jesus, gospel, God, Bible, church, it's coming out of your mouth. It says that sometimes the issue is pretty obvious, how a Christian should stand on a specific issue and what sort of solution should be proposed. But on most issues, the faithful can disagree with each other with sincerity. So don't think that your opinion is the word of the church, let alone of God. Paul VI issued an encyclical in 1967 called Populorum Progressio. And he makes a point, and Pope Francis will make this point, a lot of popes since make this point, is you have a responsibility toward everybody because of solidarity. We have to care, at least in some way, about the world, or at least not write people off and say, I don't care about you. But you also have a responsibility not just to people alive, but to future generations. You have solidarity with people who aren't born yet. And so policies and steps and measures we take today, you also have to think not just what's their impact on the poor, what's their impact on people now, but what's their impact on the future generations. Paul VI also said the church offers three special things that you get almost nowhere else. Long experience, it's been around for 2,000 years. A global perspective, it connects the whole world, Catholic Church has a presence. And then a holistic view of the human person and of human society that looks at not just the biological and physical and the economic and material dimensions, but also, moral, spiritual, cultural. In 1971, since it's a year ending in one, the Pope issued a social encyclical called Octogesima Adveniens, it's 80 years after Rerum Novarum. And he makes an interesting insight into the social sciences. So in modern times, people look to learn about a human person. They're not looking to the Bible so much. They're looking to biology, sociology, economics, anthropology, political science, history. And he says, this is necessary. We need these. These are indispensable. You need to look at reality from various perspectives and various methodologies. But there's problems with this. These different fields all have their own methodologies. They fragment reality. Partial explanations claim they're full explanations. You can talk to economists that think economy explains everything. You can talk to psychologists that think psychology explains everything, so on and so on and so on. And what you get is kind of fractured or fragmented view of things. It needs to be also kind of integrated. And not only is there this methodological fragmentation, but when you have these social scientists, you have the ideological biases of the scientists themselves. So you've got to keep that all into account. So these are inadequate but indispensable ways to look at reality. John Paul II becomes Pope in 1978, on my 21st birthday, and he issues an encyclical called Solitudo Rei Socialis in 1987. And he goes back to that being versus having, that some people are hindered in their being because they have too much. And some people are hindered by having too little. So, you know, if you're wealthy, you're going to face all sorts of temptations and problems that might get you off track. And if you're too poor, you're going to face a whole different set of temptations that might get you off track. And it's best to be kind of somewhere in the middle. Do you ever see, there's like something online where they have like, they ask, what are things that are considered really positive if rich people do them and really bad if poor people do them? And I remember one was like afternoon drinking. Like if you're rich and you're drinking in the afternoon, that's cool. And if you're poor, that's like pathetic. And there was a couple others like that where you do see this almost like rich and poor on the same issues, but they're met with differently. But one of the things that, and I know there's a Catholic church, so there probably aren't a lot of friends of Martin Luther in the audience, but Luther made that point actually back in the 1500s, that it's best to be middle class because if you have too much money, there's a whole set of temptations that you face that you wouldn't have faced as you're middle class. And if you're really poor, you're going to face a whole number of temptations that you wouldn't have faced either in the middle class. So same basic point, just made by different people in different contexts. Let's see. Pope John Paul's big encyclical on social events and affairs were Centesimus Annus. If you're going to read one document of social teaching by the Catholic Church, that would be the one to read. And if you just want to read part of it, sections 3 and 4 will tell you an awful lot of what you would need to know. So this is the pinnacle of Catholic social teaching. So he makes an important distinction between social justice and class struggle. Forget about what you think social justice is, because you know Pope's using different definitions than us, and we have social justice warriors and so on, who sometimes sound more like what the Pope's criticizing. So what would he call social justice? He says social justice is connected with human dignity, the common good, reconciliation, reasonable compromise, balancing interests. It's all about bringing people together and making compromises and so on and so on. And the class struggle is mutual hatred, it's partisanship, it's my party right or wrong, it's bringing total war into domestic politics, it's having the goal of dominating, of owning your opponent, it's using lies, terror, force, any means necessary to win. That's the best. You can see how our own society has a lot of that. So he's laying out kind of this is the way to go, this is the way you don't want to go. He's going to reiterate a lot of what Leo XIII said about the state's role. It protects property. It keeps the currency stable. We forget about that sometimes, but a government that can't keep the currency stable would be a disaster. And the damage that it would do to society is enormous. A state should provide effective public services. It should protect the worker as the weaker party. Should regulate working conditions. It should ensure a just wage. Popes are increasingly going to criticize consumer society as we move through time. You know, Pope Leo XIII, he's more interested in how workers are being treated in these big, you know, smokestack industries without strong labor unions. But pretty soon, you know, workers are going to start in the developed world, they're going to start making a lot of money. In North America and Western Europe, they're going to be pretty rich. And so the new temptation will be consumer society, just making a consumption the center of your life. And he says this is also when the capitalist world was fighting the communist world. We defeated them economically with prosperity. They both catered to material needs and the capitalist world provided them better. And he says by competing on those lines in that category, you're becoming just like the Marxist. It's all about material goods, it's all about your economic situation. and it leaves out spiritual values, it leaves out the autonomous value of law, morality, culture, religion. He also makes the point, and other popes did too, we often think of poverty as something purely economic, but there's cultural poverty, there's spiritual poverty. In a lot of ways, the wealthy West is more impoverished than anybody. In the famous sections 3 and 4, we have the Pope talking about, I'll quote, these are really important parts, so I will quote that. It is not possible to understand man on the basis of economics alone, nor to define him simply on the basis of class membership. Man is understood in a more complete way when he is situated within the sphere of culture through his language, history, and the position he takes toward the fundamental events of life, like birth, love, work, and death. At the heart of every culture lies the attitude man takes to the greatest mystery, the mystery of God. Different cultures are basically different ways of facing the question of the meaning of personal existence. When this question is eliminated, the culture and moral life of nations are corrupted. This is sort of an expanded version of what people say today, like politics is downwind of culture or downstream of culture, and then the economy is downstream of politics and culture, and so on and so on. Pope John Paul then goes on to talk about socialism, or Marxism, really, what he grew up under, lived under. He didn't grow up under it, he lived under it. Its fundamental error is anthropological. When you ask just a normal American during the Cold War, what's wrong with communists? We would say they live a crappy material goods and services, and they throw people in prison camps and mass murder them and so on. They don't have freedom, they don't have prosperity. And for Pope, it's a different list. His main concern was theological and spiritual and anthropological. And he says the whole ideology denies free will and it denies original sin. Two things that come right out of the creation story. It denies free will in the sense that it's deterministic. Marx has discovered the laws of history. He's predicting the future. There will be a bourgeois revolution. There will be a protestant revolution. There will be a socialist state. There will be the withering away of the state. There will be this and this and that. It's already determined. We're just acting it out. And Pope John Paul's answer is, we're affected by outside forces, but they don't determine our fate or our future. Things like everybody's going to be influenced by, your sex, your social class, your education level, where you live, when you live. That might constrict some of your choices, but it doesn't take them away. It doesn't destroy your freedom. You still have free will. So determinism just doesn't work. In terms of original sin, the communists are utopian. They're promising a wonderful, bright future of prosperity and equality and all these wonderful things. And John Paul says, when people think they possess the secret of a perfect social organization, which makes evil impossible, they also think they can use any means, including violence and deceit, in order to bring that organization into being. Politics then becomes a secular religion which operates under the illusion of creating paradise in the world. And he says, no political society can be confused with the kingdom of God. And the way I make this point in just about all my classes is that if you're in terms of thinking about socioeconomic political issues, if you're gonna, you could boil the whole Bible down to like two verses, one verse even, that's really, really, really worth reading. And if you read that and understand that and believe that, you'll have a pretty good perspective on all this other stuff. And that verse is when Adam and Eve get kicked out of the Garden of Eden, and God sends an angel with a flaming sword to guard the gate. And the lesson there is there's no getting back into the Garden of Eden. Human beings on their own are not going to get back into paradise. Paradise is gone forever in this world. And these movements like communism, that they're going to bring us paradise on earth, or the thousand-year Reich in Germany, or whatever. These promises of this wonderful, bright future that's always going to get foiled, and it's going to cause more damage by trying to reach that future than it is if you just simply stayed out of the way. John Paul writes, this is an interesting one. So sometimes there's this good life advice, or at least things that would get you thinking about life, whether you agree or not. So there was one of the features that John Paul, a point that John Paul makes, and I was watching a YouTube video. Anybody heard of Brett Cooper? So she's like an influencer, like a YouTube influencer or whatever. And so I watch her stuff periodically. And she had, it was a Mormon dating show, okay? And they had the guys on one side of the stage and the girls on the other side of the stage. Did anybody see this one? And they're on different sides of the stage. And so the and you have a curtain between, so you don't see what the other people look like. You just kind of hear, like, they read a statement about their life, like what their aspirations and values are and what they're looking for and on and on. So this pleasant young woman, she's probably early 20s, she gets up and she's reading that she loves to travel and she would really like a travel buddy, and she scuba dives and she skydives and she got licenses for this stuff and everything. And she seemed really nice, and then none of the guys wanted it at all. I mean, they were just like nobody would touch that. And Brett was kind of distressed. But I was kind of, I mean, I would have said yes probably if I was the guy. She sounded nice and fun and so on. But every one of the guys, if you read the comments, like, and they were just an avalanche of comments. It was all from young guys. And they were all saying, you know, Brett, I agree with everything you always say, but I do not agree with this. That woman was just not a good person to build a future with. She just looked at life like a bunch of sensations. She would get bored with any husband. She just wants to be gallivanting around all the time and not really building a future, and on and on. It was just, I don't think anybody wrote anything positive about her. It was just like a barrage. It shocked Brett. It even shocked me. But it wouldn't have shocked John Paul the Pope, because here's what he says about this. He says, it's not wrong to want to live better. What's wrong is a style of life which is presumed to be better when it's directed toward having rather than being, and wants to have more, not in order to be more, but in order to spend life as in enjoyment as an end in itself. And then he goes on and says, if you want to get married and have a family, you need someone that's going to make commitments, and you don't want someone who considers their life as a series of sensations to be experienced, rather than as a work to be accomplished. So he's kind of thrown that out there. And the, you know, people can ask, you know, how do I see my life? Is it a work to be accomplished? Is it a series of experiences to be, a sensation to be experienced? Is the Pope right? Is the Pope wrong? It's something I think just kind of worth thinking about. John Paul is also going to be sure that we don't make an idol out of the market. So he opposes the idolatry of the market. And talks about how a market economy should be understood, because it can be misunderstood. So he says, if you absolutize economic life, where the whole center of society's value is production and consumption, and there are no other values operating with power, that's not the fault of the economic system. It's not market economy's fault if you let the market economy be your god. That's your fault. That's the whole sociocultural system you live under. That doesn't have enough values that they can constrain and moderate and channel something like the powerful market economy. So in his view, capitalism, he prefers to call it a free economy, a market economy, a business economy, something that promotes the role of business, that has private property, that unleashes human creativity. That's a good system, provided it's morally grounded, provided there's a strong juridical framework that has policies and programs and so on in place to deal with any abuses, provided that its core is religious and ethical, not material and economic. So properly understood, the market economy is a very good thing, but if left unregulated and treated like it's its own autonomous being, or really domineering being, that creates a lot of problems. Catholic Church is known for subsidiarity. That's the idea that decisions should be made in social issues by the people closest to the problem. In healthcare, in education, social welfare, it's better to have local people doing it rather than bureaucrats in the capital city, and it's better to have NGOs and private companies and so on doing it rather than the state. The state should only step in when needs are not being met by others. Otherwise, the state's job is to defend, protect, promote, and facilitate the human energies unleashed by these other groups. If the state starts taking on too much and meddling in things where it doesn't belong, you have a draining out of human energies, you have an increase in bureaucratic ways of thinking, you have enormous increase in spending. He's going to comment, in the later parts of 10th Century Annus, precisely on this subsidiarity issue. Let's hit the last two popes now, before Leo. Benedict XVI, in one of the best encyclicals ever called Caritas in Veritatem from 2009, which is partly about social issues, he says, when you overemphasize rights, it leads to disregard for duties. If a right's not attached to a duty, people can just think up any rights that they want and start yelling, I want this, I want this, I want this, and nothing's being asked of them. When you detach individual rights from a framework of duties, they can run wild, and demands will keep getting escalated. The duties actually set a limit on rights and reinforce them. You know, if you have a right to freedom of speech, and then people start abandoning the duty to speak honestly, you end up undermining the whole power of the right to free speech, because people start to realize, gee, free speech is just drowning us in lies and manipulation and misrepresentation and disinformation and on and on and on. What good is it? So you actually protect your rights when you bind them to obligations. Pope Benedict talks about the environment. John Paul II, Pope Benedict, and Francis all talked about the environment a lot. Francis gets the most credit for it because the media played it that way, but popes for a long time have been talking about the environment. And Benedict XVI says, two big errors: to see nature as just the raw material to dominate and manipulate for our pleasure, or to see it as more important than the human person. He says you should not set the human beings and the environment against each other. They're on the same team. Francis will make the point as well, and they both underscore that with, if you look, the governments that abuse the environment also are the same governments that pretty much abuse their population, or the governments that abuse their people are also abusing their environments. For Francis, I'll talk about social media. He had interesting things to say about it. Anybody heard of social media? You know, okay. In Laudato Si, he says, it's impeding people from learning how to live wisely, think deeply, and love generously. If you want a motto for your life, that's a nice, live wisely, think deeply, and love generously. He says, the great sages of the past are now at risk of going unheard amidst all the noise and distractions of information overload. They're being drowned out by all the noise around us. He says, true wisdom comes from self-examination, dialogue, generous encounter between persons, not from accumulation of data, which leads to overload and confusion, mental pollution. So you can see, even though these encyclicals are about big economic and social issues, there's a lot in there that are practically, it can guide you practically in life, on a practical level. He says the new media can enable communication, yet at times they also shield us from direct contact with the pain, the fears, and the joys of others, and the complexity of their personal experiences. And I said, I enjoyed it. I thought that was a nice part of the encyclical. To sum up, chief elements of Catholic social teaching, different scholars will have different lists. The one I like best has four elements. Number one, you have human rights based on human dignity. Number two, you have responsibilities to the common good. Number three, you have solidarity. That means caring about all members of the human family with a preferential option for the poor and the more vulnerable. And subsidiarity, where health, education, and other social welfare is best addressed locally and privately, and the state should only step in when there's an absolute urgent necessity for some sort of a intervention because the problem's not being met. A huge part of Catholic social teaching is you're not an individual but a person. Individual sort of stands alone against the state. A person is in a network of relationships. People are connected in the community in this web of relationships. It's part and parcel of being human. And that means you also have an obligation to the common good, to society. And living in this complex network of intertwined communities, you're a member of a family, you're a father, mother, son, daughter, brother, sister, you're a colleague or coworker, you're a neighbor, you're a teammate, you're a co-parishioner. employee. You have tons and tons of relationships. And being a person means being in relationship. That's why the Trinity is three persons. It's not three people, not three units. It's three persons because by definition they're interconnected. It's not three individuals. The Father, Son, and Holy Spirit aren't three individuals that stand alone. But as a human being, you belong to a community. But you're not bee in a hive, you're not ants in an anthill, you're not cogs in a machine. You have rights. They're grounded in your dignity as a human person because you're made in the image and likeness of God. And this means there are serious limitations of what the state can do to you and what society can require of you or your family. So you have the obligations, but you also have protection from being asked too much of you in an unjust way by society or the state. The Catholic approach is called personalism. There's a lot of definition of personalism. It's a philosophical school. I don't want to get into all of that, but the idea that you're a person and that's what's the most important thing is a big part of Catholic teaching, especially Pope John Paul II. And unlike the individual, as I said, the person is defined by relationship to others. And as a person, you have dignity, you have protection from unjust claims on you, but at the same time, you do have obligations. You don't stand alone. With this view in mind, the Catholic Church looks at social systems. And they'll see some that violate social solidarity by not requiring community connection from you. They'll be overly individualistic. Some will take away your individual rights and impose burdens on you. You can usually find out what's wrong with a system by looking at it through a lens like that. Whether for right or wrong, the Vatican since the 19th century has seen, kind of used the United States as kind of an example of hyper-individualism. And then other regimes, usually very traditional religious societies or communism or fascism, there it's more about your community, your the collective really, and your rights are minimal. Some societies will seem to be very much about rights, and some very much about obligations. And there needs to be a balance. They need to be both there, they need to be connected, they need to be together. I was just thinking about abortion debate in the United States. When people debate abortion, it's the rights of the mother, the rights of the unborn child versus the rights of the woman. It's always about rights. It's never about what are the obligations. What obligations you have to the women, to the children, to society. That really gets drowned out. Everything boils down to individual rights in our culture. There are cultures where individual rights don't count for much and everything is about your obligations. The Catholic Church is saying neither of those approaches are good ones. So this uncontrolled capitalism, this hyper-individualism that violates social solidarity, this Marxian or even fascistic collectivization violates subsidiarity. It makes the state too strong, takes away your rights. That you're not an atomized individual standing alone. You're not a cog in a collective machine. You're a person, and as a person, you're connected to others in a community, and you have rights and you have obligations, and they go together. You can't have the one without the other, or there's something out of whack. So I'll conclude by just saying, you know, for social teaching, and you could find this at least implicitly in Leo XIII, and you find it in popes all the way to the present, and I'm sure you'll find it in anything new that Leo XIV writes. You're a human person made for community. You're made in the image of God. And because of that, you have rights, but also you have obligations. And I think that's all I have to say. So thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.